Good morning.
Good morning.
I have to say hi to my friends who are over in Chapel Hill. I live in Durham now. My name is Dr. Kim Coleman, and at the time that I actually was working on this project, I was a faculty member at Georgia Southern University in Statesboro, Georgia. I'd like to acknowledge my other co-authors, three of whom who are here, Ms. Danielle Blackwell, Dr. Adelary Odeshegun, Mrs. Zenobia Hodges, where are you? Okay. Mrs. Johnny Zanders, and Dr. Mildred McLean. I do have the following personal financial relationship to disclose that has existed within the past 12 months. I was a consultant and paid contractor with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. So I want to talk to you a little bit about New Tools, New Visions 2. New Tools, New Visions 2 was a project that was started by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, and the purpose was to bring together rural communities in Georgia, hoping that they would partner with HBCUs in their respective communities, while also providing resources in the form of faculty, technical advisors, if you will, from Georgia Southern University. And they were specifically directed to use a CBPR approach. You can see with our project goals, first and foremost, we want to make sure that the grantees' community capacity is enhanced. If we come in and all we do is act as taskmasters, telling them what to do and how to do they really learn how to do the work? And the answer, of course, is no. So we want to make sure that when we leave, they're better off than they were when we came in, and that the work that they started doing, they can continue doing somewhat on their own feet. We also wanted to, this project also hoped to engage community residents and partners with HBCUs in that area. And when we look at the topic of today's presentation being CBPR, are we really participating? One of the things you're going to hear from myself and from Ms. Blackwell is that that's a challenge. That's a very real challenge, especially working with HBCUs. The community grantees that were awarded this project were all located in Southern Georgia. They are Albany, Georgia Tools for Change, obviously located in Albany, Georgia. Visions for the Valley, which is located in Fort Valley, Georgia. New Tools, New Visions Augusta, and that project is actually administrated by Payne College. And Harambe House Incorporated and Citizens for Environmental Justice, which is a long-standing community organization in Savannah, Georgia. I don't know how many of you are actually familiar with Southern Georgia. I went to school, undergrad, in Atlanta. I had never heard, first of all, of Statesboro. I had never traveled any further than Macon. And you can see where Atlanta is. And so it was very interesting. If you look where Statesboro is right here, that's where Georgia Southern University is located. And then you look and you see these rural areas, Augusta, which is approximately about 100, maybe 150 miles away from Statesboro. Fort Valley, which is a bit longer. Albany, I had to learn how to say that correctly. If I said Albany, I said it wrong again? Oh, okay. Albany, sorry. Okay, Albany. I'm a northern girl. I'm from D.C. And then Savannah, which is more urban than all of the other four, but has its own challenges as well when you start talking about issues in working with the community and social justice and CBPR. So the purpose of me in this project, I was the technical assistance coordinator, and I do need to talk about how this process took place. The grantees were awarded their grants first. then an evaluation team was actually put together, and I was actually the last piece of the puzzle. All right, and I say that because those of you who are familiar with CBPR probably are going to sit back and say, don't know if that was probably the best way to do things. I was tasked with the following, and that was to educate all of the grantees on the basics, if you will, of CBPR. And we affectionately called that CBPR 101 or CBPR 102 if you talk about Albany, right? Okay. to help coordinate the communities being able to branch out their professional social networks, if you will, so that they could actually not only be in contact with each other, because there was something for them to learn from each other as they were going through this process, but also branching out and expanding those networks in their communities. I was tasked to be the project liaison. So instead of all four communities calling Michigan on a regular basis when they had questions for Kellogg, I then became the filter. I had monthly progress calls with the project manager. I also had monthly progress calls with most of the communities, sometimes more, sometimes late. And I also had scheduled site visits. I did have to use some of my facilitation skills to help with help the community see how to facilitate meetings so that they would be effective. I didn't do that too much, but for a few of the communities starting out, I did have to do that because there were some organizational issues that needed to be addressed. We had planned on doing a grant workshop in the first year. We never did get to that, so that particular purpose or objective was never met. And then to collaborate as needed with the evaluation team, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that right now. So this was the organizational structure of how this project worked. We had at the top our Kellogg program manager, then you had myself, and I was a team of one, is what I called myself. Then you had an evaluation team, which consisted of four doctoral level trained health professionals. Four had degrees in public health, different areas of public health. One had a degree in nutrition and dietetics. And then you have the four communities here, the four community grantees. I stayed in regular communication with the four community grantees. However, the communication between technical assistance and the evaluation team was sparse. And that was done originally because we wanted to have an objective evaluation. I question some of that now, that decision now, because I think in the long run it actually did hurt the process a little bit. So some strengths with that organizational structure. The grantees did have a mechanism for reaching the funder. That was a lot better than having four different people call sometimes in the same week to find out information. If one had a question and it was relevant for the other grantees, it was very easy for me then to email a response so that everybody understood. I know one of the first issues we had to deal with was use of the Kellogg logo. And that question came up, and it was like, oh, you know, I don't know. So we did make a phone call and found out what the procedure was, and then that information could be disseminated to all four grantees rather than just having one person ask it and the other ones be in the dark. Strengths was with the relationship between the TAC and the evaluation team was that there was an opportunity for dialogue. We did meet together sometimes. However, there weren't regular meetings. And so that, you'll see, was a bit of a weakness as well. Network development and enhancement among the grantees, especially, I know, between Albany and Fort Valley. There were many times where they were going through some similar things, and I would say, you know, Danielle, you need to call Miss Zenobia, or you need to call Miss Johnny, and you need to, because they're dealing with the same thing, and vice versa. And so a lot of times they were talking with each other, and they didn't need me. Some weaknesses. With the evaluation team, there was no lead evaluator. Each community had a primary and a secondary evaluator for each site. And sometimes that was a little confusing, I think, to the partners, to the communities, and to myself. Grantees had and still have limited communication with the evaluation team. The evaluations are done on an annual basis, and that's pretty much when they hear from the evaluation team. And this hierarchical design that I showed you before might not be the best design for a CBPR type project. I think we can always learn from trying. And sometimes you try things and you fail, but then you learn how to move on from those. Some of my lessons learned deal with role delineation. If hindsight is always 20/20, if I were to go back and do this again, I talked about the order in which this project was put together. If I were to do it all over again, one of the things that I would do would be to sit down and take myself and the evaluation team and have us clarify what our roles were going to be, what our operating practices were going to be, how we were going to communicate with each other, what information they needed, what information needed to be withheld from them, if anything. I think then we would make sure that the organizations and communities would actually understand the structure, the organizational structure that of how we were going to interact with each other. They never really got that piece, and so that was something that I would say I would do differently. And then work with the organizations or community members to delineate the roles and responsibilities, what they kind of wanted from us, what they wanted to see, what types of information they really wanted for us, how they wanted evaluation to go. Whether or not they wanted us to come up with, or the evaluation team to come up with the questions first and then run them by them. Or do we all want to be at the table and develop those research questions together? I would definitely conduct a formal and informal needs assessment with the community, both the evaluation team and the technical assistance coordinator, before we started. One of the things that that I really focused on was the fact that as a TAC, and because I was having so much more communication and involvement with these community members, I built a very strong rapport with the community members. And it was really interesting to hear from them their concerns. And one of their concerns was to really be part of the collaborative evaluation process different from how it was set up, because the evaluation process was set up ahead of time without involving them. Also understanding that there's valuable qualitative data in being a TAC and actually looking at the dynamics of doing CBPR, especially among African Americans, and then, as I said, with this project, in collaboration or trying to be in collaboration with HBCUs. And then making sure that the TAC agrees to adhere to the organization's guiding principles and operating practices. And not just the TAC, but I would say also the evaluation team. Communication, lesson learned. Dialogue was required. We had some instances where someone would say something and then I wouldn't hear from someone for 3 months. And I'd be emailing and I'd be calling. And it's not like I could run down the road, because it's not like these places were all that close. And so it became kind of difficult when all you heard was silence. And so understanding that dialogue has to be required and sometimes pushing that. As a TAC, definitely being willing to listen and not what I call already always listening, which is somebody's talking and you're already figuring out in your head what you're going to say next because they're wrong no matter what and you can't learn from them. And that's why I said it applies to everyone, even me. Power and control. Anyone who's done any work in group dynamics or any reading on group dynamics knows disagreement happens. I mean, those of you who are married probably can, you know, attest to it. Okay. So it's normal, but it's the inflexibility that derails the process of any project, and especially a project that is utilizing a CBPR approach. Conflict resolution takes skill and takes courage. I will tell you that sometimes in working with this project, I had to take off my PhD, if you will. I had to throw the hood, take the little TAM off, and forget that I had a degree, and just get real, and call foolishness out as it was, and say, look, what are you interested in? Are you interested in helping the community, or are you interested in making a name for yourself? If you're interested in making a name for yourself, this is not the project to do that in. And did it hurt feelings? Yeah. Did it make people mad with me? Yeah. But I'm interested in the work. My commitment is to the work and to the communities. And so sometimes that's what you have to do. Control issues were often seen with the academics at these HBCUs. I just will be very I'll be very honest. They didn't want to give up control. We had professionals publishing without involving the community. We have issues in how to use money that is designed or designated for the project but wants to be used for a party that the steering committee members are not involved in, are not invited to. Okay? So there's this whole issue of WIFM, and I call that what's in it for me. And so sometimes with these academics, cut them loose. Because if they're not willing to work with you as a community, you don't need them. There are plenty of other organizations and well-meaning, not I won't say well-meaning, and well-doing and ethical professionals out there who do want to work with you. Cut them loose. Cultural humility, I picked this. I'm a big tweeter. I was tweeting like a fool yesterday. During the opening session. But I love this piece, this statement by Dr. Cornel West. In a democratic chronology, it's important to have patience, to get to know people, to be open, to create bonds of trust. And you've heard trust talked about before. Trust doesn't happen automatically. Trust happens over time. And one of the things that I had to do, and this was something that, quite frankly, I learned, I went to Michigan, so I kind of learned this from some of my training there, was that sometimes you just need to shut up and listen. And sometimes we went out to eat. We didn't talk about anything that had anything to do with CBPR or Kellogg or school or whatever. We just talked about life. We got to know each other. They got to know me. I got to know them. Miss Johnny and Miss Zenobia let me put my cat, when I was doing a site visit, I didn't have a cat sitter, three cats running around the center in Fort Valley. Okay? But that's, you know, what happens. Support the programs because you care about the community. I've gone to health fairs. I've, you know, gone to parties, whatever. I've gone to dinners. Support. Show that you care. And that's how you build trust. And you've heard it before. Be authentic. They can tell game, okay? You're phony, it's going to come out. I'm going to really wrap it up. I love this cartoon because it talks about community campus communication. And this little car here, this is HBCUs. Because it's not going to go in the direction that everybody else is going. I mean, yes, academics tend to go off to the right. The real world is concerned with, are we going to get the job done? HBCUs are a whole different ball game. And I'm going to tell you something. If you don't understand the history of HBCUs, and especially the HBCU in that community, then you're going to have some problems. You've got to understand the history and how the community views that HBCU, because it will make a difference. All this to say that, I'm going to skip through this, all this to say that you definitely, I think that you do need some sort of technical assistance in doing CBPR in the community. Some of these qualifications came from my community members, because I asked them, I said, well, you know, what do you think if you had to write down a job list, or, if you will? Congenial, are you approachable? As you can see, obviously, I'm pretty approachable. What you see is what you get with me. This is how I am all the time. Making sure you have some management experience, even some event planning experience can be helpful. And we've already seen it before, flexibility. My final thought on this is that when you start seeing CBPR work and take hold in the community, if you are truly, as we learned yesterday, a servant leader, it makes your heart feel good. It really does. And so when I, as I've started seeing over the past 2 years, this project and these communities grow, it has really warmed my heart, because I can tell you that they're not afraid anymore. And they stand up and they speak out. I want to acknowledge, and if you're here, just stand really quickly. If you're from Albany, Georgia, Tools for Change, if you'll stand. I want to acknowledge Karen McWhite, who's not here, Danielle Blackwell, and Ellis Harris, and we have members of the board who are here as well. Visions for the Valley, I want to acknowledge the project coordinators and Bishop John Moss, who is the president. Payne College, Reverend Terrence Dix, again, Dr. Oni Shagun, and Dr. George Bradley, who's the president. Harambe House has two project coordinators, Lynn Pender and Anise Fardon, as well as the executive director, Mildred McLean. And then our former project manager from the Kellogg Foundation, Terry Wright, who some of you know. If you want any more information, please, by all means, contact us or contact me.